Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of The Real Ones Podcast. I'm your wonderful host, David, and this week I'm joined by Darren Leo. Darren is a comedian, writer, and keynote speaker in Toronto. He performs stand-up comedy across the stages of Yuk Yuk's, Absolute, Comedy Bar, and SoCap. You can find Darren performing weekly at The Real Jerk Legacy and The Cameron House. Talking with Darren was really a lot of fun. It was really awesome to get some insight into comedy and everything that goes into a comic telling their jokes on stage. We talk about the creative writing process, overcoming stage fright, how to connect with audiences, and so much more. I hope you all enjoy. I want to take a moment to welcome you to The Real Ones, Darren. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, man. It's good to see you, David.
Yeah. For all the listeners who definitely wouldn't know where we met, Darren, you were performing at a comedy show in Toronto. And for me, you were really like the standout performer there. Your jokes, I mean, everybody was phenomenal, but your jokes just, I don't know, they were just something special for me. I found them so funny. So I came up to you after the show. I think I just said hi. I don't even think I actually introduced myself. I'm just like, yeah, great job. And then I followed you. Because literally the second I walked away from you, because I was talking to my girlfriend just before, I'm like, oh, I really want to ask him to be on my podcast. Should I do it? Is it going to be weird? Ping-ponging in my head. And then as soon as I walk away, I go, fuck, I should have asked him to be on my podcast right there.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad you still asked, though. This is so fun. You know how much this means? You know how many comedians are fighting for stage time and people's attention? Let alone being asked to be on there, like the hard work that you're building and then to be invited to the podcast. Hell yeah. You should always ask.
Thank you. Comedians,
we love the stage. Doesn't matter if it's like comedy stage or the digital stage on the podcast. It's amazing.
Right on.
Yeah.
So you as a comedian, I'd love to know a bit about kind of what or who might have inspired you to get into comedy in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you were like when you were a kid. I don't know if you ever had any sort of dreams that you wanted to do or have when you grow up. I never did. But I just remember being a kid, I was fascinated by just, like, the comedy as a genre, like in movies. Mm-hmm. Like Ace Ventura with Jim Carrey. I remember as a kid, I would mimic his movement. Just think that, oh, it's so funny. You can do something that made people laugh. And then like Back to the Future. I remember watching Back to the Future. Like, I love movies. I would watch Back to the Future. And Michael J. Fox, you know, he's a short guy. I'm not a very tall guy. Mm-hmm. And he's like not physically imposing, but he's just got charm. He's got charisma and it's funny. And I was just fascinated by this idea of someone who's funny could do so much more. And like Jim Carrey, also not a very physically imposing guy. Not the best looking dude either. So I'm like, hey, like that's, it's so interesting that you can be the main character, you can be the cool guy just by pure charm and charisma and humor. So I think that really sat with me for a long time. And I didn't really realize how much that was the root of many things. And then my family moved to Canada when I was 16. And that is around the time Dave Chappelle's getting up. He was having a lot of his specials coming out, like, you know, Killing Them Softly, For What It's Worth. All these great specials were coming out. And I remember that was my first gateway into true stand-up comedy, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this is crazy. People can actually go on stage and just talk for an hour and everyone's laughing and he has an idea. And that really just stuck with me and I never explored it. But I think, I don't know if you've been told about certain aspect of your life, Dave, but like growing up, people always tell me, oh, you're so funny. Like usually you're like the funniest guy in the group. Mm-hmm. And I've been told a lot, like not to. Like, it sounds super pretentious, but like, you know, sometimes it's being told, like, hey, you know, you're super funny. And you're being told that your whole life to a point. As you get older, you'd be like, wait, am I really funny? Should I explore this? Mm-hmm. And obviously, as you slowly transition into the professional world, there's more opportunity to be on stage, to present or in client meetings. And that you started to see, oh, maybe I have something there. It seems like every time I speak, I have an idea. I can seem to convey it in a way that's very palatable because I can make it funny. And I think that really just things started adding up together in recent years more and more. I don't think there was like a moment of trigger, but I do remember a year ago, I told myself that, hey, you know what? Because all of these things that have happened in my life, I should try stand up once, just once. And I remember just over a year ago, I told myself, I'm going to go to open mic and just do it once. And then if I bomb, whatever, and if it goes well, maybe I'll try it out. And I was so afraid, and I slacked off the entire year. I didn't do it. Comes like December that year, I have like 12 months to do it, like end of December, when all the clubs and all the mics were shutting down. I'm looking at the schedule, I'm like, if I don't do it now, I will never do it this year. So I picked one, and I wrote 5 minutes of jokes, and I just went and did it. And then thank God I did okay. You know, I did okay. And that's all it took for you to get hooked.
Wow.
So yeah.
What was it about that first successful experience that really kind of put you onto comedy and got you to want more and more?
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like you went on stage, first of all, you're super scared, right? Mm-hmm. You're sitting there waiting for your name to be called, and you see everyone going on stage, some of them bomb, some of them get great laughs, and you can't even concentrate. And then you just keep repeating your jokes inside your head, and you feel like nauseous. And then when your name's called, you step on stage, you look around, you just try to think of all the jokes you've written, and then you start saying one word, you say a sentence, no one laughs, and you say a few more sentences, and one of the jokes, you will just hit. And then you just pause and you hear everyone starts laughing at that one joke. You're like, holy shit, like that worked. And I think just that one moment, that was more than enough for people who are passionate about comedy to be like, okay, I want to chase that moment again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really like taking a drug, a shot of serotonin. You just like, I want to hit again. I think just that quick moment of shit, this worked.
Yeah. It sounds exhilarating, honestly.
It is very, yeah.
And so, you know, like my feed, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, whatever, especially after going to my first comedy show, which was where I saw you. That was my first comedy show ever. It's been filled with, I don't know, like Matt Rife, all those guys who are pros doing it full time. And it's like, when I see their videos for an hour straight, they're getting laughs on every other word they say, it seems like. So I wonder, what is the journey, you know, for, I guess, a part-time or a non-professional stand-up comedian to get to that point? What is the real reality?
So you mean professionally, as in like to get on the world stage, or to have a long set where you have really like high laughs per minute to output?
I think just like the journey to, you know, that these professional comedians take, it seems like they're experts at telling jokes and everything hits. But what's maybe the reality for people who aren't professional comedians yet?
Oh, I see. It definitely is a journey. I think journey, you said, is a good word. Like one of the things they will tell you, and I read a lot of stand-up comics books, is that you need to have laughs per minute, and many laughs. How many laughs per how many minutes? One thing I think people need to know is, in every joke, there's always a setup and there's a punch, right? And ideally, you want a setup to be very, very short so you can get to the punch and laugh right away. And I think many people who are starting out, that's what they try to do. It's like set up, punch. And I think that's totally fine. That will get by at a pretty decent show, maybe the 4 to 5 minutes of a mic. And maybe if you're lucky, you get a 7 minute spot and you can expand that to a 10, 15 minutes. I think that is, so it's okay. But I think as you probably also saw at Absolute Comedy that night, sometimes I would take my time with a setup. I even spoke Mandarin on stage.
Yeah.
For like a good 10 seconds where nobody understood what I was saying. And I think that is when I feel like I'm touching onto a little bit beyond the traditional setup punch, where I know people are laughing a lot during setup punch, but you can make a setup also funny. Maybe the premise is around something that's already funny. So on your way to a punch, you can also make it funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's not funny, you know that your punch is going to be so hard that you can get away with a longer setup. I think the difference between like an amateur and a professional comedian is that the amateur ones, they really try to play the setup punch game, whereas professional ones, they can stretch a very meaty setup. So they make the punch hit so much harder, and then along the way of having a meaty setup, they can still make sure you're on the hook. You're still paying attention, and maybe there's jokes hung off the setup all the way to the final punch.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that takes a lot of stage time. It takes a lot of writing for you to get there. So I think the true journey is really just like stage time and really think about how you can reframe a setup many times in a way that is interesting, and you don't need a punchline every minute because it's going to take you longer to get there.
Right. That's interesting. Laughs per minute. Like,
yeah, it's a thing.
Because what you were saying earlier about like being told in a group, like, oh, you're so funny. I've had that happen to me like a couple times, and I've always thought, oh, it'd be kind of cool to try to do stand-up comedy, but I get so, I can't even think of a way to formulate jokes, you know, or how to come up with them. So I wonder, what's your creative process like when you're actually writing the content for your sets?
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit. When I first started off, I wanted to just write about, like, I start off with like a lot of observational comedy, which means I'll take an idea and I'll be like, okay, here's what I think of this idea and why I think it's funny. I think naturally I want to write stuff like that because there's like, I feel like there's almost limitless to the things you can observe and the things you can make funny. But over time, I think I've changed a little bit into personal storytelling, as you could see from my set. I feel like I like to talk about myself as I mature more and more as a comic, because I feel like audience really connect with the authenticity of it. So my creative process, one thing is, every comic does this, is day-to-day life. We see something funny, we'll quickly write it down in our phone or on our note, in our notes, and just be like, all right, I gotta come back to this and explore this. I think that happens to every comic. But for me, I'll actually just sit and try to write, even when there's no specific thing I have in mind. So one of the things I do a lot is, earlier we talked about reading. So I love reading. And every time I read something really interesting, I don't care if it's funny or not, I will make sure I write it down. And I'll write that idea and I'll be like, okay, this is super cool. This sentence, this quote, or this story, I'll write it down. And then over time, I think that just more or less becomes material for your set without you even realizing. And that has been something that's been really helping my creative process. It's just like something that I read a long time ago. And then maybe my joke isn't about what I read, but it's a joke, but something that I read that reminds me of something else that happened in my life. And then I write a joke. So it becomes more of a triangle. It's often a triangle. Something I read reminds me of something that happened, and then that becomes a joke. And that's now more of my creative process. And also just personal stories. Like, you know, as I'm living through life, I'm like, okay, this is an interesting period of my life. I think I need to talk about this. And I would just write a whole story, maybe like 10, 15 minutes of like speech or talk track with no jokes at all. And then I'll go back when I feel funny, I'll start hang jokes off the actual story.
Interesting. I like that. That seems like a nice way to go about it. And almost like, do you find that writing jokes ever get stressful, especially when you maybe experience writer's block?
Yeah, it's yes and no. Like so this is pretty fucked up. I like stress.
Okay.
I really like stress. I function really well under stress. I like tight deadlines. I like it when it's like distractions, a lot of things that like try to get you done. Some of my best material, they're actually written like on my way to the club or when I don't have a lot of time. So I'm like, I gotta get this thing down because I gotta close my laptop. It's like I have some sort of restriction. That's when I come up with the best material. And that's why sometimes I will like stay up late at night because I'm like, oh, I gotta go to bed soon. And then the idea of like my night is ending, I gotta go to bed, will force me to write something. And usually good stuff will come out. And then when it hits, it just hits you like a truck. I'm like, I gotta write this down. So in dealing with writer's block, I actually like stress. I like to artificially create stress if I can. And sometimes I'm gonna walk to work, a 20-minute walk. I'm like, okay, just think of one thing that is funny on your walk to work, or refine one joke that you have that you've been working on or something. Any sort of artificial deadline that I create for myself actually helps the writer's block.
Interesting. I've heard about that where it's like there's two kinds of stress. One is the stress that's considered negative and it's can create anxious thoughts and worry, like when you have a tight deadline. But then there's another form that's called eustress, which to me, like that's kind of what I relate to with that positive stuff where it's like, okay, maybe you have a deadline, but that pushes you to complete your task quicker and you get things done on time. So that sounds a lot like what you experience. And I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. Yeah. What about you, man? Like, what is your, like, what is your process? I'm sure you create a lot too. I know you have your podcast. Mm-hmm. What else do you do?
I think creatively, the podcast is the main thing I do. Mm-hmm. I'm also a coach for a youth basketball team.
I saw that, yeah, on your Instagram. Yeah.
Oh, appreciate you looking out mm-hmm. there. Yeah. I find that really interesting, kind of manufacturing some situations. Mm-hmm.
Do you, like, in your approach to coaching youth, mm-hmm. do you try to create a stressful environment, like obviously healthy stress
yeah.
for them? Or do you, are you one of those just like everything is positive, that's just positive reinforcement?
You know, it's interesting because at first, when I first started coaching earlier this year, I tried to formulate everything in a very, everything's positive, everything is good situation. So even if somebody screws up big time, it's, well, I mean, it is perfectly okay, but I kind of didn't want to stress the mistake they made, you know, to keep it positive. Right. But as I've coached more, I realized how important it is for me, I feel, to actually explain what they did was wrong, but then offer them a solution at the end of it and kind of still have that positive element, mm-hmm. but try not to eliminate the negative, like the negative result, you know, like,
right.
like in my practices, yeah. like they're very young, they're just hitting puberty. So they have all this adrenaline and testosterone. So sometimes these young boys say things that they don't mean, you know, rude things that aren't fit for like the environment. And so
yeah.
I kind of try to take that as a teaching moment for them, you know.
Okay.
And that's how I try to help them kind of have like a growth mindset. Be like, okay, you made a mistake yeah. here. You said this thing that wasn't right. That's not okay. Take accountability. And this is how we move forward.
Yeah. Do you find there's like a difference in their reaction since you changed your approach?
I think big time. I noticed that before they were pretty like lax. They kind of maybe didn't take me seriously all the time and didn't see me as a coach
yeah. Yeah.
or of someone that was like being their yeah. friend. But now I feel like it's much more of, they see me as a coach and there's that mutual respect going both ways.
Oh yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
It's almost like you have to create respect. You almost have to artificially, I don't know if artificial is the right word, but like create a little bit of a separation, distance. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that distance is created through discipline.
Yeah.
On them.
Yeah, you know? 100%.
It's hard because we all want to be like the cool big brother, the cool dude that's just like, yo, we're so cool. But like, you kind of need to have a little bit of distance, at least psychologically, to make sure that, hey, yeah. I'm here to teach you something.
Exactly. Like literally, that's yeah. perfectly put. So speaking of distance between people, when you're on stage and you're making jokes, and I feel like, at least from what I heard, I felt like the stories you make are very personal and there's almost like a sense of vulnerability. So how do you balance yeah. that with the humor you're trying to bring across to the audience?
Yeah, man, that's such a good question. It's funny because when I first started off, I didn't do any vulnerable stuff. I just like, I want to tell jokes. Mm-hmm. And now I realize I want to be as vulnerable as I can. Because one thing I'll say this, talking about balance between the two, I don't know if this is like right comedy mm-hmm. advice, but this is what I go with, is that I find the more vulnerable I am, the funnier I need to be, mm-hmm. because, or else you're just feeling sad about yourself. It's like, so like, I feel like I like creating vulnerability, but you need to have a redemption moment, a redemptive moment where it's like, oh, this is hilarious. After all this vulnerability, this is what's so funny about it. So I try to balance that too. It's like, I don't be too vulnerable to a point like, hey, this is supposed to be a comedy show. We don't want you to feel sorry about yourself. Right. Like, I think some of the old comics would tell young comics, like, don't use the stage as your personal therapy. Don't come up here yeah. and just like rant and then just talk about how shitty your life is. I try not to do that. I try to be vulnerable as in like exposing my weakness, exposing the struggles that I have mm-hmm. and the funny things that happen as I try to overcome the struggles. I think that's how I do it. So to balance out the two, I don't know if there's like the right formula to it. I just one thing I really care about is, do people care about my vulnerability? Like, is my vulnerability, can be like, it can be easily associated for them on a personal level. Like maybe other immigrants have experienced something like this. Mm-hmm. And then the punchline that comes after it, the funny part that comes after it is also, do they also have something that it's similar, that they think it will find funny if that happens to them, or maybe it has happened to them in some capacity mm-hmm. and they never really find a chance to articulate it, and I'm doing that for them. So whether it's the funny part or the vulnerability part, I want to make sure that they're at least just relatable. That's sort of how I go about it. And I think it's pretty easy in Toronto. You know, the diverse audience that we have is pretty easy to be relatable, I would say.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to what you said about authenticity, that's something I got from your set right away. Like, I could tell you're just being yourself, sharing stories. There was no, like, alternate comic persona necessarily. It was just you.
Oh, I see. Telling jokes, right.
Which is what I enjoyed.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. It's interesting that you talked about, use the word persona, because a lot of comedians, they talk about their comedic voice. Mm. They're still developing. And I am too. It's like what you might sound like on stage, what you might sound like off stage. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure you see some comedians that on stage, they might have like super deadpan act, and that's just how they are, or some of them like super hyper. I am still developing mine, but to your point, I want to be as close to my regular personal self as possible, because I find if I put on an act, maybe my act isn't consistent and then I might break character. I don't know how it is. I'm not sure. But it's something that we're all still developing for sure.
Definitely. Speaking of crowds and a connection, this is something that I've always wanted to ask a comedian, so I'm very excited to ask you. So it's on the topic of hecklers and, I guess, crowd work.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I'll try to articulate this how I'm thinking about it, and hopefully it comes across right. So when I watch comedy shows on the internet and I see, like, comedian X handles heckler expertly, is there like a sense of like this culture in comedy shows where hecklers kind of are almost like an expectation? So people feel like they need to heckle in order to make a comedy show fit this narrative or expectation.
I would say no. A lot of this heckler part, that stuff that you see on the internet, I feel like a lot happens in the US. If you notice, in Toronto, people are pretty nice.
Yeah.
Like, I've had hecklers, but none of them are like aggressive or mean. A lot of them are like actually just happy hecklers. Like, they're enjoying themselves and they're a little bit too vocal and they end up disrupting your set. But I don't think I've experienced one person who was like aggressively negative towards, like, oh, you suck and all that. That hasn't happened to me yet. But I will say, it is like every comedian's, we should practice some form of crowd work. I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fan of crowd work. I like writing. I like delivering stories and bits. So I like the performance of it. But I force myself to do crowd work just to get myself connected to the audience, but also just practice being on my toes and then also riffing. But I will say one thing that's very, I think it depends on the comedian. Also, you've seen my stuff. My stuff isn't really like, there's not much to heckle about. Like, I'm not, you know, I don't talk about anything crazy controversial. I don't have a really, you know, some comedians, they have a persona on stage where they're like just the bravado or the act of them, like they're inviting crowd, inviting hecklers. I don't know if I invite that, my persona, but I would say if it does happen to me, I usually just kind of like my comedy, I always have a angle. Because there's a difference between how Darren handles hecklers versus how David handles hecklers. And I always make sure I have an angle. And my angle is always like this Asian guy with immigrant angle. So it's like, how do I, as an immigrant, how do I feel about this situation? And I think that keeps the crowd work a lot under control, a lot easier to manage. Because whatever happens, I will always have a default attitude towards it, which is like an immigrant attitude. It's like, as an immigrant, here's how I feel about it. For example, if a white person heckles me, I can say, well, as an immigrant, you know, I'm used to it. This is not the first time a white guy cuts me off when I'm trying to speak. Like, that's an angle.
Yeah.
Right. So I think having an angle on stage saves you a lot of like trouble when you're dealing with uncertainty. You just kind of go back to your angle a little bit.
Interesting. Is that angle similar to having that stage persona, or maybe it's like the baby steps you would take to build out that persona because it's something you're defaulting to?
Okay, so yes and no. So here, you touched on something very interesting. What you said is stage persona, but I think what it really is, just like what audience would see, is like who you are as a comedian. Who are you? right? I don't know if you like, or some of the listeners, they have had some experience where it's a public speaking environment, and they wrote a few jokes, maybe it's at work, and then they said a few jokes, and they're objectively funny, but no one laughs. I don't know if that's happened to some of the listeners here. And that's because people don't know they're supposed to laugh. People don't know that's a joke. They're not ready to laugh. Something could happen in comedy, but on a different level, meaning before you even say your first joke, you should have a handshake with the audience. And I'm not talking about a real handshake, but I'm talking about like a verbal handshake. And that handshake will be the first few sentences out of your mouth. Right away, that's going to set the stage to who you are, what kind of comedian you are, and what kind of humor they're about to experience. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important in the beginning of every set. And over time, when you have a name for yourself, you have your own following, maybe you can bypass all that, you can jump straight into the jokes you want to tell. Yeah. But I think for most comedians in Toronto, we need to do that. And that's the persona you're talking about. Because if I go straight into talking about random jokes, about Asian jokes, it would take people a while to be like, oh, this guy's here talking about all Asian immigrant stuff. Mm-hmm. But if I open a set with something really personal about me being Asian or about me being an immigrant, that's a signal to the audience that, hey, be on the same wavelength with me for the next 15 minutes. Because next 15 minutes, we're going to talking about this. We'll be talking about this now. So I think that's reset every set.
Wow. Interesting. That's another layer to comedy. I never knew, right? That's really eye opening.
Yeah. I mean, you could do it without, I would say, but I find I always do better when I have that.
Yeah.
Just like, hey, be on my side now. Let's have this conversation together.
Yeah. And I mean, I can imagine, especially just from my experience of being in the audience, having that sentence that sets the tone, especially when there's so many different types of comedians coming on every so often.
Yeah.
It's nice to have that little reset. Be like, okay, this is kind of their angle. This is what they're going to joke about. I got you. And I'm on your side. Just like you said.
Yeah. Especially when the show that you saw at Absolute Comedy, the host, phenomenal host, but he didn't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
So he would just next comic. He didn't really say much about each comic. So it's like, I don't know if you noticed this, like at one point people were still laughing at the previous comic. They were still trying to fall out of love with the previous comic. And then the host is already on stage introducing the next one. And the next comic will come up. And then the first maybe a minute or 90 seconds, it's almost a bit harder for them to make a connection with the audience. Because the audience is still trying to fall out of love and fall in love with the next act. And they're trying to be on the same wavelength. And you want to avoid that. So why not just use the first 60 seconds, just like say something about yourself, maybe say something about your act to like, okay, reset and get them on your side, and then jokes.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that when I'm looking back. And even for myself, I found it hard to flip that switch and differentiate almost between the first comic and the next. Because I'm focused on how the first one maybe didn't make me laugh as much, or that one was super hilarious. I'm like, fuck, I can't forget about that joke. And the new comic is coming on, and it just feels like it's not a good experience for anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. That was very, very, like, that was very tight. That was a very tight show.
Yeah.
Amazing. Great show, but it was tight. I really feel for some of the audience members like, wait, oh, next comic. I'm like, oh, there's so much. Mm-hmm. Even me, I was listening backstage. I'm like, oh man, this is so quick. I don't have time to digest the previous set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For that set or for that show, at Absolute, how long did each comic have, other than the headliner?
About 7 minutes or so.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. It felt like a couple minutes. Okay.
Yeah it's very short.
Time flies. Like it's so impressive, and I'm very captivated by the skill that comics have to be able to say so much, get so much energy, so much laughter in 5 to 10 minutes. Like that is insane.
Yeah, it's definitely like the word economy. Mm-hmm. Is very much talked about, right? If you can say the same idea with fewer words, please say it, because we don't have a lot of time. You know?
Question for you about kind of the process of making jokes, going back to it a little bit. When you're writing jokes and you're trying to come up with things to say, what is your focus on? Is it writing something that you find funny first and foremost, or are you thinking about what the crowds are going to find funny?
Ooh. Oh, wow. Okay. That's a great question.
Thank you.
When I first started off, I write things that I think other people will find funny. Mm-hmm. And that was okay. But I realized when I started writing jokes about things I find funny, it is way better. And it's not because I am funnier than the audience. It's because it starts to become more authentic. Mm-hmm. It starts to like, okay, it's coming from me. And the main difference is the love that I put into the bit that I'm writing is so much more because I think this is funny. I want you to see it the way I see it. So I'm giving it so much more love. But also performing that joke, I am so much more into it because I'm like, please just see it the way I see it. I promise you, if I can just convince you this, be on the same journey, I promise you, you will see something that you didn't see before. So I changed gears, I would say, like very quickly when I started to make it more about me. And it sounds super like self-centered, but yeah, I actually think the more I make it about me, but not in an egotistic way, but just like, here's what I truly want to tell you. I think it actually comes up way better than the other way around.
Definitely.
But with that, I will say this though. Obviously over the course of a year, you collect a lot of material, mm-hmm. and you have this mental catalog of all the jokes that you have. Every show, before I go on the show, I will just look at the audience. And if I have the privilege of not going first or not hosting, I will make sure I pay attention to what are some of the jokes people are not laughing at. Mm-hmm. And I will know, okay, this crowd likes certain type of joke, or this crowd has a lot of immigrants, or has a lot of non-immigrants, has a lot of women, doesn't have a lot of women. Whatever it is, I noticed, I will change my set according to the audience. So that is me picking things that I think will resonate better with this audience. But these things are still written from the angle that I find funny.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And I totally see that. I mean, one, from the authenticity, that's the biggest thing. But I feel like in my experience, as just a person who's not a comic, I've been told many times that whenever I tell a joke, I'm always laughing the most at it.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's like, if you're telling a joke, especially as a comic, that you yourself don't find funny, how can you expect anybody else to find the humor in what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And it's so funny you said that, because I actually got my wrist slapped when I first started off doing comedy that I was laughing too much at my jokes. I actually went to a comedy competition in that very same room where you saw me about, like, I don't know, I want to say 8-9 months ago. I went to a comedy competition and I was laughing at my own jokes because I really thought it was funny. And afterwards, I lost the competition and I was like, oh man, that sucked. And then they gave me feedback and there was like 4 or 5 judges and they all said unanimously that you laugh at your own jokes too much. You got to stop doing that. Wow. And I'm like, oh shit, okay, yeah. So I toned it down a little bit, but they think I was trying too hard. Uh-huh. But I was truly having a good time. They think that I'm trying to sell the joke by laughing at it myself. But in my defense, I feel like I was really having a good time. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, I toned it down ever since.
Interesting. When you're telling jokes to audiences, how do you balance, if you have these thoughts at all, but the thoughts of hoping that, you know, everybody finds your joke funny and also trying not to care too much about it and just do what you love to do?
Oh shit. That's hard to balance, man. It's really hard to balance, especially as new comics like myself. Like, we're nobody. Like, so one of the first things you do is you want people to think you're funny.
Right.
So I do find this. Unfortunately, sometimes you pander to the audience a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I say a lot of Asian jokes and a lot of immigrant jokes, obviously, because that's things that I care about the most. I always believe things you care about the most offstage should be the things that you talk about the most on stage, mm-hmm. because that's what you think about the most. Why would you not? But a part of that, sometimes I definitely dig deeper into sort of the East Asian theme more, mm-hmm. because I find audience, they like hearing that. They like hearing an East Asian guy talking about an East Asian topic. Mm-hmm. So I would dig a little bit further into it. It's a little bit pandering, I would say sometimes, because they like this, so I'll dig deeper into it.
Right.
And then I find once you do that for a while, you start to build up the muscle. You started to become universally funny. Mm-hmm. You can start pandering a little bit less, and you can start to talk about things you don't want to talk about. sorry, you can start to talk about things that you want to talk about, but audience might not be on board, but you want to talk about it anyway, because you're that much better of a comic, you can deliver that. So there's definitely that struggle. I still had that struggle. And I have like a bunch of bits where I really like the premise, but they don't really hit because they're not as, they're not about Asian bits. They're not about like immigrant stuff, but it's things I find funny. I will randomly just pull out and I will just say it on a random show. I'll sandwich between the, you know, the more refined stuff just to see what else I can get away with talking about things that I think audience might not want to hear from me, but I still want to say anyway.
Right.
I think as we get more and more mature, experienced, and also hopefully more well-known, we'll care less and less about that, and we'll just have our own audience. You know how they, like, for example, if like Dave Chappelle and goes and sells tickets, I know for a lot of people he's controversial, but he still sells out arenas because he has his own audience. He has his own followings. There are people who will care to listen to him regardless. And I think that's the place eventually comedians want to be, because then you're truly honing your own craft the way you want to do and connecting with your audience, right, who choose to be there with you. I think that's a luxury that a lot of young comics don't have. And we just have to try to be universally funny for now.
Wow. So that's kind of like maybe the end goal from a broad, you know, perspective of having that community that loves you for your jokes, and you don't have to change certain things. You can be your honest self.
Yeah. And I would say for now, it's not that I change stuff, but I notice certain things, certain jokes that I say, they're not as funny as say some of the immigrant stuff that I talk about or the Asian stuff that I talk about. So I don't get to lean on those pieces of jokes as my primary. If I say I only have like 7 minutes absolute, I am going to lean the most heavily on my best jokes, which are a lot of usually immigrant jokes. Right. But if I have like 15 minutes, then maybe 5 minutes out of the 15 minutes are some of the stuff that has nothing to do with immigration, nothing to do with ethnicity, just things that I want to talk about. Like one of my favorite, some of my favorite bits is about food poisoning. It's so juvenile, but it's about food poisoning. And then every time I tell that 5 minutes set, it's always hit and miss. Sometimes people think it's so funny. Sometimes people are just like, okay, cool. You know, let's move on with the different stuff. So things like that. It's not that I'm changing myself by telling the Asian jokes, but I am selectively choosing what jokes I'm telling depending on how much time I have.
Right.
And if I have the liberty to talk about something that people might not want to hear from me as much.
I love that. When you're looking at your first performance, or even 8-9 months ago, and you look at your most recent set, how has your perspective changed on what a successful joke means to you?
Yeah. Okay, so I think there's like two answers. One is it didn't change, and one is that, and the other answer is that it changed a lot. What didn't change is that I think the purist in me wants to say that funny should just be funny.
Yeah.
And like, doesn't matter if the joke is highbrow, lowbrow, dirty or clean, as long as the joke makes people laugh, that should be a successful joke.
Yeah.
I think that should be hopefully universally true for people who like to laugh. So that's sort of how I see it. But obviously the other part of me also see that a successful joke is now is beyond a funny. I feel like a laugh, I want a laugh to have a lot of emotional content. It's very important for me to deliver emotional content behind a laugh. Like one of the most beautiful moments that I've actually had is I told 15 minutes of jokes about white people running. It's one of my favorite 15 minutes of joke, and I actually can't deconstruct this into smaller sets, because the whole thing is about, like, from beginning to end, it's about how I, as an immigrant, see why people love to run, and how I, my final takeaway of it all. But my final takeaway has a crescendo about, I have almost like a 7 to 15, I don't remember, it depends on, I would say 15 seconds. It was almost this monologue about why immigrants do what we do in Canada. And there's nothing about it is funny. I talk about like our real struggle, and I'm being really real and vulnerable. And because I know I have a final punchline coming up, so I want to bring a lot of emotional content into it. And by then people have laughed a lot. I think I can get away with a little bit of like TED Talk.
Yeah.
So I launch into like a 15-second TED Talk. But it's very emotional to me, I think. And then I saw in the audience a girl, she did this, and then she just teared up.
Wow.
And that was the best moment of my entire career. It's like, this is a comedy show, and she physically held her hand and she teared up, and then I delivered my final punchline. Obviously everyone laughed, and that was one of the best shows that I've had. So I think that laugh at the end is so different now from, you know, 12 months ago, 13 months ago when I first started off.
Yeah.
It's a laugh that's has so much more emotional content to it.
Wow. That, like, I feel the energy coming off just you saying that, like how much that meant to you, that experience. And I love that. Seeing that.
Yeah, it does mean a lot. Yeah. Yeah. I really like to talk about things that are emotional to me. Mm-hmm. Like even the set that we talked about, like you sing at Absolute, where I talk about the things that my dad said to me, those things are 100% true. You know, how like don't embarrass our people. Mm-hmm. You got to act like accordingly. And this has all really happened. I'm like, I want to take these moments of like teaching moments that I've been pounding into my head that's not supposed to be funny. And I want to share that with you. And then hopefully we can like laugh in levity. I think that's very important to me now when it comes to the success of a joke.
Yeah. And I think like those jokes, for me, as somebody who's not Asian and hearing these things, it just like opens my eyes a little bit to different cultures and different people's experiences. In a way that is a little more lighthearted, I feel, than, you know, a sit-down conversation.
Right.
So it's nice. I really love that you have that aspect.
Yeah, thank you, man. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was awesome. That whole set, it was so funny. I'm still, like, I laugh about it when I think about it because it was so well-delivered and everything was just fantastic.
Yeah, it was a great time. That's a great room. That's such a nice venue. Everyone's happy. Mm-hmm. All the comics are where everyone's nervous as hell because they run a tight ship. I don't know if you don't know. I know you don't. Most people don't know, but backstage they run a super tight ship. They will be like lights, like music, like flicker this 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, music up. All right, go MC, go. Like they run a super tight ship.
Whoa.
And then they will be like comics. You have 7 minutes, and then once you get off stage, they will write down how much time you actually used just to make sure you know that if you went over or not. And that day I went over by 30 seconds mm-hmm. in specific. But they wrote it down. So they're like, Darren, 7 minutes and 30 seconds. I'm like, oops, sorry.
and so what does that mean if you go over? Does that just mean that the other comics or the next comic has a little less time? Or how does that like factor in? What's the point of that?
No, they wouldn't do that. So a good thing is that they don't do that. Mm-hmm. It just means the audience will go home a bit later.
Gotcha. Okay.
So what they're really trying to do is have a very controlled experience for the audience. Mm-hmm. If we tell you that show's going to start at 8 o'clock, we're going to start at 8 o'clock, and we say that show will end at like, you know, 9:30, you're going to get out of here by 9:30. Mm-hmm. They want to be responsible for your time. And I think I like that. I respect that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I do too. Like, because it was my first show. I thought we were going to, I don't know, I forget when we actually got out of there, but I thought we were going to leave at like 11:30. I didn't know how long it was going to go for. I thought it was going to be like a 3-hour show, but
yeah,
I do like that. And is that like common practice at most places, or is that kind of maybe specific to Absolute that they do that? Oh, no, okay.
It's definitely more specific to Absolute, and then like Yuck Yucks too, to give credit to Yuck Yucks and maybe Corner, like to some of the like actual comedy clubs that are more well run, mm-hmm. they will try to adhere to a more specific start time and end time as much as possible. Absolute, I would say they're definitely more famous for how stringent they run mm-hmm. their show, which full props to that. But I would say if you go to most of the, another thing I should say is a lot of comedy shows, actually they happen outside of the comedy clubs. Like, so there's only about like, 4 or 5 major comedy clubs in Toronto. That is not a lot. Mm-hmm. So most of the shows actually happen outside of comedy clubs, music venues, bars, random places with a stage. I've been to like, you know, random bookstores, like just anything that could hold an audience. There are way more shows that happen in that environment. I'm actually going to a show soon that's in the gym. So that's going to be weird. Yeah. So those places, they definitely are looser on their start time and end time.
Yeah.
And it's not because they don't want to adhere to the time. It's more audience. They don't show up on time.
Yeah,
so they kind of like just kind of distinct the audience, kind of they just don't really respect start time when it comes to comedy shows. So we're kind of just wait until people show up and then we'll start.
Right. Well, that's good to know, because how is that going to work at a gym? Is it like while people are working out, you're talking to them, or is there like a stage?
So yeah, so this one I was told. So I'm not producing it. I'm being invited there as a host. Mm-hmm. But I think there's like an exercise room that they're gonna put up chairs, and they're gonna just do it there. But it's like during gym hours.
Okay.
So there will be like one guy outside just deadlifting and freaking bench pressing.
Hell yeah.
While we're inside telling jokes.
You see a dude just bodying 320 on the bench press while you're telling a joke?
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to be interesting. I think that's going to be a unique experience. Have you ever done something like that at a gym?
Not at a gym. What would be the weirdest place that I've done jokes at? You know what? I haven't done any super weird venues, I must say. They all mostly bars, you know. Like, and I'll be honest, I would rather tell jokes at a bar at a gym than like a full-blown bar with no proper stage. Because with a full-blown bar with no proper stage, people don't want you to be there. People want to be there having drinks with their friends, especially when they don't know there's a comedy show going on. Like some bars, they will say this is a comedy night, you come in for comedy, that's fine, I'm okay with that. But sometimes they just do like a surprise show. A bit, oh, hey, this is a comedy show tonight. And people just like, what the fuck? Like, I'm here to have drinks, to catch up with our friends. And they don't want to listen to it. They would just talk amongst themselves. And you're trying to do a show. Oh, man, that's the worst. That would really like humble you. Like, you know, I did a few of those in the beginning. That really humbles you as a performer. Just like, okay, nobody cares about me.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
With comedy shows, and I don't know. I don't want to, like, I love comedy shows. I think they're amazing, but I have so many thoughts because, like, I don't ever talk about, I guess, like, the deeper layers to comedy beyond it, just a comic, like maybe like the cultural aspect of it. So,
yeah.
Have you ever found, I don't know if you've ever thought about or what you think about it, where it's like people go to a comedy show because they expect to be entertained for 7 minutes straight, or I guess for the duration of the whole set. So, I don't even know how to articulate this question, but I think it's just like that in and of itself. Like, I find that so interesting that I went there because I expected to be entertained. And
yeah,
do you find that maybe as people go to more comedy shows, the comedians need to level up their jokes and make it even funnier than before?
Interesting. Wait, okay, let's go back. I want to hear your experience because that was your first comedy show, but I assume you've seen a lot of like Netflix standout specials.
Yeah, I did.
How did that compare in terms of overall experience? Not the caliber of the comic, but I just, as a listener, was that somewhat what you expected?
Yeah.
The format.
Yeah. I think the format was, it was, I mean, I don't think I had any expectations, but I definitely wasn't surprised. I wasn't caught off guard like, this is a strange way to do things. I think the one thing that was actually a surprise that was a pleasant one was that the host, I forget his name, but the jokes he was telling were funny. And that surprised me as well. Like, in between all the comics, there's another comic right there just transitioning.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So to quickly, I just want to quickly comment on that. To have a successful comedy show in person, it is incredibly important to have a good host. A great host could really make a show, and a bad host could really potentially break a show. Because you're the structure of the whole show.
Yeah.
The audience need to like you. Because if I hate you as a host, why would I care about this next guy that you said has been crushing and you love this guy, next guy so much? Right. I don't even like you. Why would I like someone that you like? So having a really good host, it's easier for comics to go up and just crush. Having a bad host, I've done many places where the host didn't care. It's not that I wouldn't say they're bad hosts or they're bad comics. Maybe they just don't care. Maybe the audience wasn't vibing. I would have to spend the first few minutes almost re-host the show myself, just to get audience back on our side. But okay, how's everyone doing? You guys doing okay? Like, talking to them, do a bit of crowd work, just get people back to our side.
Yeah.
And that kind of sucks because you then eats into your actual material time.
Definitely.
So I just want to comment on that. But as far as like the experience from the audience perspective, one thing I've noticed quite interesting is the show that you went to, Absolute Comedy, is probably as close to, when it, obviously I'm talking about like non Netflix special or like these touring comics, Hollywood level shows, theater shows. Aside from theater shows, that Absolute Comedy environment is as close to a full proper show as he gets in Toronto. And Yak Yaks too. But very often you get like a basement of a random place, and it's a lot more grungy.
Yeah.
It's a lot more personal. And you get lots of like this show, you know, in Absolute, you have the lights, the music, you come on. It's very much like a show. You can sit there and just enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Very often in comedy, other comedy clubs, it's not as much like that, right? It's a lot more intimate. It's much less high production. So what ends up happening is the way comics tell jokes will be a bit different. Mm-hmm. And the way that we engage with the audience will be a bit different. It will be a little bit more crowd work, a little bit more jokes that are specifically directed to a specific audience. Might not be a joke at your expense or about you, but it might be like, hey, I see that you're Jewish. And I will say, oh, you're Jewish, and I will tell a Jewish joke, mm-hmm. for instance. Comics will try to be more intentional, mm-hmm. as opposed to just going up and deliver material. That happens a lot more in smaller clubs, mm-hmm. I would say. So what's interesting is sometimes, especially what we notice is, two things. People who haven't been to a lot of comedy shows or haven't been to any comedy shows, but they're very used to, so let's say that the Netflix of the world. Mm-hmm. They come to a comedy show, or say like people who live in the suburbs, so they are not as much in the Toronto sort of culture. They come to a comedy show, if they happen to go to like a sort of like a basement type of show, they would be so weirded out by the experience. Because mm-hmm. it's not what they have expected from what they have seen on TV. Yeah, this is a lot more personal, a lot more grungy, a lot of like impersonal engagement, a lot of like riffing. So I would say that's very different. And you as a comic, you have to tailor your jokes. Like to like a show like Absolute, when I know it's more of a high production show, I know I can go up and I can just do a show.
Yeah.
But if I get invited to like a basement of a random bar, which is like 30 people in the audience, then I'm not going to go up and do this whole showy thing. Like, hey, like, what are you doing? Like, it's 30 of us. Why are you up here doing this whole show? Yeah. You know, this is down here. You know what? How I would distinguish the two? When I'm at a show, like a big show, my energy is like here. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm here doing a show. But when I'm at like a basement, my energy is like more like here. It's more centered or closer to my heart.
Yeah.
And I'm more this. And that's why a lot of jokes, it will bomb at certain venue, but it will do really well at other venue.
Yeah.
So going back to your question about this audience experience, it really changes, depends on what kind of audience you are and also what kind of comedy club you're at.
Right. Interesting. I'm gonna keep that in mind, because I definitely want to try to go to more shows and see new things. And if I end up going to one of those basements, I guess the grungy ones, I'll be interested to see how that changes and how the comics shift. I want to do a little segment I'm trying out. It's called Real and Rapid.
Okay.
It's going to be three questions. For each question, you'll have 30 seconds to answer it.
30 seconds. Okay.
Yeah. So hopefully it'll be enough time.
Okay.
So for the first question, what's the strangest way that you've overcome writer's block?
Okay, so this is the strangest way, but it didn't work. But I'll tell you anyway, because it's hilarious. So I was desperate. So what I did is, whatever what I was doing wasn't working. So I want to stimulate my body and my mind with something completely different. So I went to the supermarket and I went to the international aisle and I picked out a bunch of random snacks from all over the world that I had never tasted before. And I went home and I just sat down with a drink and I just sat eating on this random snack, different flavors, some of them good, some of them bad. It's like, hey, if I can somehow like stimulate my body in a way that's never been stimulated before, I can get out of this writer's block. It didn't work at all, but it was fun. It was a strange way to do it, but it didn't work.
Awesome. No, I kind of feel that, like, I don't know writer's block necessarily, but I kind of like to do random shit and just see if it can fix something or if it can get me out of a funk or anything like that. So I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I think talking helps. If I just keep saying it, when like no one's around, mm-hmm. I just keep saying my jokes. And then I'll pretend I'm performing, mm-hmm. because I'm creating the artificial pressure that I have to say the next sentence. And I'll be like, okay, how do I say it? How do I say this? And I look like a crazy person when I do that. But it helps. Yeah.
Right on. Second one. What is the most hilarious or unexpected situation that you've found yourself in one of your sets?
Okay, this might be more than 30 seconds.
Go off.
But I want to say off. Okay, so I was performing at one of those basement-like place, and I was telling a lot of Asian jokes, and there was a white middle-aged lady sitting close to the front with her friend, and they were loving it, and they started joining in on the jokes. But the way they join in is like as if they're Asian too. So they started just making these Asian racist jokes that usually should be told by me, but not by a middle-aged white woman.
Right.
And they were just going for it. And I thought it was so funny because by the way they were saying it, they were not trying to be racist. Although it sounds super racist, like a white woman making Asian a racist jokes, but I know they're doing it because they are so bought into the jokes I'm doing. They want to like add to it. And then I saw it was so funny. And then right when it started saying, I kind of looked at the crowd just to see like how the crowd was doing. And then there was like a 2 second pause and the crowd just erupted into laughter. And then everyone just laughing. And then that was, and then I just started riffing. I wish I didn't record that night. Like I record everything, that specific segment I didn't record. And then we're just talking, having a good time. And then they were giving us more racist jokes and the crowd's laughing even more. And I'm saying it back and I'm shitting on white people. And I feel that was so good. And that was such a nice moment because you heard a lot about comics being canceled and this cancel culture and everything. Everyone has to be careful.
Yeah.
I feel like that moment, it was so nice because it's like, hey, let's all leave whatever political belief, how woke we are. Let's all leave at a door and let's all talk in the place where context and intention matters. And the context and the intention, this old lady said she's not being racist. She's just having such a good time. She wants to contribute to the jokes I'm telling. And everyone else sees that I'm having a good time. So no one else is offended on my behalf.
Yeah.
Because I'm, hey, if I'm not offended, you don't have to be offended. So can we all just have a good time? And I feel like that moment is getting, those moments are getting rare and rare in this day and age. I'm not saying that we should all go out and just say inappropriate jokes about each other, but I am saying that when intention and context are taken into account, we can be all a lot more lighthearted about what is in front of us. And just like whatever prejudice that we have, I feel like they get overcome because I like you now more as a person than whatever prejudice I have against you before going into this. And now after this, we're so much closer as a result. And I think that's why comedy is so important in today's context. So I think that is like this super unexpected, super bizarre, but also super precious moment.
That's amazing. And, you know, I totally see what you're saying about context and intention mattering so much. Something I've heard, especially online from friends, is like when you go into a comedy show, you have to expect like there's no limits. You know, everything's on the table.
Right.
And I think that, that's an important thing. And I mean, I personally wasn't offended by many jokes that evening. Have you ever encountered people that maybe during the show, after the show, are like, what the hell is that? I just didn't like what you were saying.
I have encountered, yeah, I definitely have. Because here's the thing, I think intention matters, but at the same time, you cannot be irresponsible in the way that you are saying certain things. Right. For example, there are certain comics, and that, like, obviously I'm not going to name names, but there are certain comics, they are into that kind of stuff, like just more offensive stuff. There's that group. I am not plugged into that group, but some of them thrive on this. And some of them, they actually have been banned from clubs as a result. They have been getting complaints for, and these, some of these are like really like working full-time comics. They are way more senior than I am. They are way more well-known. They have a name for themselves. They have a following. But at the same time, they say these jokes that get them banned at clubs. It still happens to this day because while their intention is to make people funny, but they kind of, you could tell they're being irresponsible with the way they're telling it. And they just kind of, it's like, are you trying to be funny or are you trying to be racist? Like when you can't find that line, then that's not good, right? So that's definitely has happened. I personally, I try not to step into that territory just because it's not, I'm not trying to censor anyone from what they say. But at the end of the day, you have to be responsible for the things you're saying. You don't know who's listening. You can make jokes, but at the end of it, it's like it has to be funny. Right? Like funny needs to be first. Like whether you have your personal political agenda, I think that should be secondary. I think funny needs to be first. And when something is not funny, hey, you know what? Then you're risking being a racist, or you're risking being a bigot, or whatever it is that you're trying to do. So I think funny needs to be first.
Yeah, that's what I saw a lot from some of the sets and even online, whatever. It's finding a balance, just like you're saying, and being funny first and treading that fine line. And I've definitely seen people, I mean, even in my own life, who are not comedians, just people, try to make jokes that are put under the guise of dark humor.
Mm-hmm.
But then whatever they say, it doesn't sound so much like a joke or a dark joke. And it's like, well, you're just being racist. That's it.
Yes, it's like, very perceptive.
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And it's almost like, using that dark humor as a blanket or as a cover for just saying whatever messed up things come into your mind. And that's, I find that awful.
Very smart. You're very smart that you picked that up, because you see, like, to your point, the audience smart. They can tell a difference between someone's genuinely trying to make a funny joke and it could potentially a bit racial, but it's a funny joke that we all just want to laugh, versus, like, to your point, using it as a blanket for them to really rant on another race or another visible minority, whatever it is that they have issue with. And the audience can smell that from 100 miles away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like that, I mean, you know, obviously we can't speak to that, or I can't at least, because I don't make jokes and I haven't seen that happen on a comedy stage. But maybe as a comic, you can speak to it a little bit. When those things happen, maybe not necessarily being a bigot or like crossing the line, but when a joke doesn't hit the way you want it to, what is the process that you try to follow to bounce back from it?
Oh, that's very interesting. When a joke that I wrote and I go on stage and I perform and it doesn't hit, what do I do to bounce back from it? You mean right on the stage or afterwards?
We'll say on the stage.
And then so also afterwards. They're actually, okay. So on stage, sometimes I don't acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. I just keep going to my next joke because I'm like, okay, it's fine. I don't get the next joke, I'll get the next joke.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. But if it's like a much more relaxing environment, for example, like those basement, some of the basement shows where it's much more intimate, a lot of interaction with the audience, sometimes I will acknowledge it. I'll be like, oh, okay, I see that you guys don't like this, you guys don't like that. And sometimes you can make a funny moment out of it, right? And usually the funny moment comes from what happened before the set. Maybe someone else said something, you can reference to a comic, say, oh, this comic said this earlier, you guys loved it, and now I said this, it's not funny. You can find ways to recover or use that as a funny point that you all... The way I see is that if I choose to do this, I have to do it in a way that we are observing a bomb all together. I just bombed this joke. Let's talk about it as a group. Why we all think that's funny. And I think that sometimes I recover from that. But so it depends on the venue. Like, for example, if I absolute, like if more of a show, if I bomb a joke, I'll just move on because I know I have another joke coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I have no time to acknowledge it. I have no time to recover. I'm just going to power through it. But if it's like a less formal environment, I will try to make a joke out of it. But after the fact, that I always watch my set after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then just to see, like, is it the way I said it? Was it not clear? Or was the audience just not vibing? Or whatever it is, you can always find out why it isn't. Usually when you watch it again, it's pretty clear to you why it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
At least for me, I think, okay, I did this, it didn't work. I shouldn't have said it this way.
Right.
So I think as shitty as it is, you got to watch your own stuff. You watch your own material. I watch myself, especially when I really bomb a set, that's when you really need to watch it.
Mm.
I don't watch, when you kill the set, you'd be like, okay, great. I'll watch it when I feel bad about myself. I'll watch, but when I bomb a set, I'll sit in the car before I go home and I freaking just watch this, get it over with. It's so cringeworthy. And you watch it and you see what you did wrong. And then I will watch it again on mute. I will see what I look like. If people can't hear me, what is my presence like? Do I lack stage presence?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the way I do this that made a joke not funny? Or maybe I'm overselling it so the audience knows I'm ingenuine. I'm not genuine about this. What is my body language? And I watch myself on mute just to see if that makes a difference. And that usually gives me a lot of insight.
Interesting. It's almost like, would you say that as much as the actual words you're saying has a huge role on the audience's enjoyment and your success, but that body language and how you present yourself physically is also a huge contributor to your success.
Yeah. For me, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Some other comics, I also have seen comics who just love standing in the middle of the stage, sometimes they don't even move the mic. They just have in the mic stand and they just deliver a funny set. I think that's their persona and that works for them. But for me, I like to use the stage. I like to just be more active on stage.
Yeah.
And I think part of my jokes, part of my storytelling process, I like to emphasize, you know, the ebbs and flow of the story with my physical act.
Right.
So that to me personally is important.
I love it. So the last question I have for this segment, which...
Sorry, I totally ruined your 30-second
no,
thing.
No. Don't worry, I love it. Yeah. I love it. But the last one here is, well, for a bit of context for everyone to know, Darren, you're also a keynote speaker.
Yes.
So as somebody who navigates both the comedic stage and the keynote podium or behind the keynote podium, what's the most unexpected skill that you've picked up?
I would say the most unexpected skill I picked up would be connect with the audience, how to connect with the audience. So when I think most people too, when you're first doing stand-up, you have like, you know, I don't know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes of material. You go on stage, you say it, and you come back down, and you wonder why you bomb, or maybe you wonder why it bombs in a place and it doesn't bomb in the other place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the main difference between a more seasoned comic and a less seasoned comic is they can connect with the audience before they deliver the joke.
Mm-hmm.
I think connecting with the audience is very, very important because you change the way you say it. You change who you look at when you say certain things. And I think that's very much transferable when you speak at a business setting. This is going to be more than 30 seconds again, because this is so fascinating, because I will change the way I deliver a keynote based on who's in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I will change the way I describe certain things. If I see there's a lot of older people in the audience, I will make sure I touch on subjects that they care about,
mm-hmm.
right? More maybe about retirement or things that I think they will be more into. A lot of young people, I can be a bit more lighthearted, knowing that they might be more closer to my wavelength in terms of mental maturity. We're all immature, but that's the same. But one thing that is super different between the two, though, which is also fascinating. I know I'm over 30 seconds, but I want to say this because I find it to be so fascinating, is they are the polar opposite when it comes to what you talk about. Being a keynote speaker in a business setting, you always talk about the audience. They're the main focus. What do they care about? What do they want to get out of this next hour?
Mm-hmm.
You're on stage for an hour. They better care about what you want to say because they want to learn something. It's all about them. Being a comedian, the longest set I ever deliver is like just 20 minutes. So it's not very long, but it's long enough. It's all about yourself. Because you don't know who's on the stage. In the keynote speaker event, people signed up with the business topic in mind. They're here to learn about one topic. So you want to make it about them. How can you take away from being a better communicator? You come to the comedy club, this plethora of different types of people, different background, you can't make it about them. You have to make it about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you can make it about yourself, you take them into your world, and then you share that moment, share that 15, 20 minutes together, and then you use that as a connection point, because you know there's no connection point between these people. You become the connection point of that night. And I find that to be the two polar opposites in keynote and stand-up.
Wow. That's powerful, honestly. That realization, I like that. And especially...
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah.
And so when you're talking about yourself a lot and you're that focal point, for myself, even when doing this podcast over the 30 plus episodes I've done, I found myself getting a bit more comfortable actually talking myself like I'm doing now, like actually contributing to the conversation and making it a conversation rather than just like, here's one question, you go talk for 5 minutes. It just feels better. But did you ever have any difficulties starting early on where you were talking so much and it was all about you?
Mm-hmm. Like you mean as a keynote speaker or as a comedian?
As a comedian.
Like, did I have trouble talking about myself?
Yeah, and kind of just being at the center of attention, having to come up with everything and being that main focus.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of stage fright versus, like, it depends. Like, there's like two elements. One is like how comfortable you are just being on stage,
mm-hmm.
even just in complete silence. I think that's a big part. And the other part is exactly what you talk about. I think what I had problem with in the beginning is connecting with the audience as soon as possible. earlier we talked about that handshake.
Yeah.
Like, what is this about? What are we going to talk about? Why were you here? Why do you even care? When I first started off, I had a harder time establishing that, and I didn't know that was important.
Yeah.
I just go on and start saying material. I'd be like, hey, you know, what do you know about Chinatown? Chinatown is this. Like, I remember one of my first jokes is about Chinatown. I just go on and start talking about Chinatown. And just like, now it's a bit different. Now I'm like, hey, I'm talking about, like, I'm an immigrant, and here's how I feel as an immigrant about Chinatown. Now that's very different than just, hey, you know Chinatown. Like, mm-hmm. So I think that is a bit, I struggled with that when I started off. But as you do it more and more shows, you start finding your rhythm on how to quickly establish that common ground.
Definitely. Darren, are you a believer in manifestation at all? Or like speaking things into existence?
Yeah, I think so. Wow, that's it. Wait, are you a believer in manifestation?
I am, yeah.
Okay. I would love to hear from you how you approach this subject. Like, how, when you talk about manifestation to someone who doesn't know the concept, how would you describe it?
Oof, that's a good question. Okay. I feel like if I'm going to talk to somebody who's not familiar with the concept, I found that in the conversations about it, people have this idea about manifestation where it's like, all I have to do is say it and think it, and then that'll become my reality, and that's it. I don't have to do shit. I can be lazy. And the first thing I tell them is that's not what it is. You know, for me, mm-hmm. manifestation is having a goal in mind and actually speaking it out, putting it into the universe, and wholeheartedly believing that it's a possibility for me. And then with that, I also have actionable steps that I know are realistic and I can achieve, like, that are kind of setting the path to get to where I want to go, to that ultimate goal. And that's what manifestation is mm-hmm. for me.
I love that. I 1000%. That's how I see it as well. I think you touched on the two really main words. One is believe, one is action. Mm-hmm. I think I believe in the power of manifestation is because if you truly believe in something, then you will start actioning as if that's going to come true one day. And that action will then eventually bring you to where you are. But you gotta act on it.
Mm-hmm.
You really got to act on it, right? And it's sort of this thing where, kind of like this whole, I feel like it's a very healthy cycle that you do. It's like, you tell yourself that you're going to do something, and then you go and actually do it, even though it's just a smaller step, you're building your confidence in yourself that I can trust myself mm-hmm. to do this one tiny step closer towards my goal. And you do another thing, right? When I told myself a year ago, say, I'm going to step on stage just once, at the end of the year, I did it. I'm like, okay, fuck, I did it. And then I'm like, okay, that's not that bad. Let's do it again. And then let's do it again. And then a year later, now I have shows every single night. It's just like, because I believe in myself one show at a time. Yeah. And same as you, like, I'm just going to do this one thing because I believe one day I will be that. So I'm going to take that action. So that's how I see it as well. Yeah. But is there a reason why you asked that question?
Well, I asked it just because I had a conversation in the past episode I released with a florist who has her own business in Toronto. And we talked about manifestation. And it was for me, it was a very like powerful and I guess very engaging conversation to have. So I was just wanted to bring it up just to see what your thoughts were on it, see where it would take us.
Yeah. One thing I would say about manifestation, though, it was just like an interesting topic, too. I don't remember which researcher said this, a psychologist said this. So it's important manifestation is you also want to be careful around what you put out there to other people, because if you say, apparently psychologically, if you say something a lot, you will also almost priming your brain to believe that you have already achieved it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you will actually take less action to do it because you've already sort of show off your idea to others.
Yeah.
Like the idea being that one of the reasons why we do what we do is that we also want social validation.
Yeah.
But if you already get your social validation by talking about it a lot, your brain will almost create that social validation less, which in turn, then you take less action towards that goal. So for instance, you can say that, I want to retire in Europe. And you keep saying that all the time, yeah, I'm going to retire in Europe. You keep saying it, Eventually, you might just not do it because you say, oh, you know what? Mentally, you already prime yourself by saying it. It's almost you already had the satisfaction
yeah.
of announcing it. Because part of the satisfaction is announcing that.
Yeah.
So if you announce it several times, the magic goes away. You just won't crave it anymore and don't end up doing it. So apparently that's also a thing. So now I'm like, fuck.
Interesting.
I can't tell anybody about what I manifest. You know, I have to put in a piece of paper and just like send it off into the universe.
Yeah, that's one thing that I've seen on social media. It's kind of a part of that hustle culture, which I don't like at all for me personally. Where it's like, you have to hustle in silence. You can't tell anybody what you're doing because people are going to be, you know, preying on your downfall. People are going to want you to fail. And that's a very dark, like a negative outlook on everything. And so I wonder in kind of the culture of comics and comedy, what's the culture there? You know, is it like a dog-eat-dog world or are comics lifting each other up and trying to share a piece of the pie with everybody?
Honestly, it's super mixed. It's so mixed. There's certainly a lot of comics who are just like dog eat dog because we all want stage time. But for the most part, I think in Toronto, it's not bad. You know, I surrounded myself with good people.
That's good.
So like we all like, I really don't like this idea where like, only one of us can make it. I think we could all make it. Like, why does it have to be one of us? Yeah. I understand it's a smaller percentage of us will eventually make it on the big screen. Statistically speaking, this it's gonna be very few of us.
Yeah.
But like, we should all give each other opportunities, right? That's why I produce so many shows in Toronto. I co-produce 4 shows a week.
Oh wow!
Because I'm like, yo, if I produce more shows, more comics can have more stage time. I can have more stage time, and let's all just rise. Let's just all like benefit from it together. So I try to surround myself with good people like that, mm-hmm. and I definitely stay away from comics who are just like, hey, you know, it's either me or you. And comics know, we know who those people are. Mm-hmm. And over time, you can see we flock towards people we like better. Mm-hmm. You try to protect yourself that way a little bit. But honestly, there is definitely that negativity in some comics, for sure, if you're not careful.
Yeah. Well, I think it's amazing that you have that community and friends and colleagues that, you know, you're lifting each other up. Because I feel like, especially in a space where, you know, so few can make it eventually, having that community that's positive. And in the meantime, while everyone's trying to get up to the highest level of comedy, you're having fun, you're uplifting everybody. Yeah. And throughout the process, it's a positive experience.
Yeah. And also like everyone's so unique.
Yeah.
It's not like you can't tell my jokes, like, and I can't tell your jokes. Like it doesn't have to be just one of us.
Exactly.
So, and also honestly, there aren't that many Asian comics in Toronto anyway. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot, but I only know like 4 or 5 of them. So.
That's a niche. There you go.
Yeah. But hey, earlier you mentioned social media. What is your relationship with social media?
Oof, that's a convoluted answer for me. I think at before social media, and do you mean in like just a personal sense or, you know, thinking of it like as a brand and social media marketing before anything?
Oh,
Or just generally.
I guess, for example, this podcast, mm-hmm. or like you're trying to grow your brand through podcasts and also your personal account. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you view it? Do you view it to be an essential part of your brand strategy? Do you view it to be something that's more of a distraction? Do you have an unhealthy relationship with social media? Because I know I do. So I just want to see how you approach that as a medium. Mm-hmm.
Well, firstly, I want to thank you for the question because this podcast, like mental health and that aspect of conversations is something that I love to highlight. So I'm happy that we're diving into this direction.
Mental health.
Okay. Yeah. And that's kind of what I thought of with social media and that unhealthy relationship. I think and recently it's definitely become unhealthy just with everything going on in the world. I've been checking my phone a lot more compulsively. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there's so much information on this little screen or whatever screen I'm looking at. It can kind of cloud my perspective on what's really around me. And it kind of clouds what I can be grateful for. And it makes my perception of life darker and more dull. So that's on mm-hmm. the personal side. It's been a distraction. It's been a hindrance because I'm looking at it so much and I feel shit about myself. I feel bad about everything going on in the world. And I'm not taking the time to really be present and grateful for what I have now, even the small things.
Okay. Yeah.
But from a business, like from a brand perspective, I think it's so important. I mean, you know, if with social media, I think that time is the most valuable currency on there. you know, time watched on your reels, time spent on your profile, time spent interacting. People's time is the most valuable thing that we as creators have. Yeah. And so I think that finding ways to maximize that. And it's unfortunate because I don't like looking at people, or and I try not to ever look at people as, you know, a currency or like as a number on the screen. So me, I have a small following, but I try to look at it as like when somebody likes that my post or comments or whatever, I see it as them, you know, taking the time out of their day, spending energy to interact with me. And so I think I look at it from a place of gratitude. And so I appreciate it. And I really take that time to like think about what it means beyond just a number on my screen.
Gotcha. Okay. Wow. So you're really trying to go for quality and just like being responsible for using people's time.
Yeah. And then on the other side, one of my most recent posts on my feed, I went online, I looked up like, it's like some kind of meme. It's some shit. I made it for free on a website and I posted it because I thought it was funny. So it's like, that's not the highest quality thing I could have posted, but I thought it was funny. So definitely is a balance.
Yeah. You're talking to a comic. Yeah, we post just most random stuff. It's so funny because a lot of comics, we actually post like the shittiest stuff that we have because we don't want to burn the good stuff on social media.
Oh, interesting.
That's why there's so much crowd work on the internet.
Crowd work considered like, not low effort content, but I guess like the lower end of what a comic can post?
No, I wouldn't say it's lower as an art form. I think it's equally great, but it's just like, it's not material.
Okay.
So this exchange probably won't happen again. So I'm just going to post it. And that way you still don't know my material. Like for example, the 7 minutes that you heard, if I post it on social media, you know, obviously I don't have a big following, so I don't think it matters that much. Mm-hmm. Most people won't see it. But imagine you've already seen it and you come to Absolute Comedy and you see that 7 minutes, but oh, I've seen this. We don't have the element of surprise. So we like to keep the best stuff there. So I think a lot of us, we just decided to post either crowd work or bits that are relevant to like, you know, St. Patrick's Day or like Easter, things that are more timely.
Interesting.
And then, yeah.
So is that the reasoning for that? Is it like to kind of give potential listeners a taste of who you are and to give them a sense of your personality, but not give away your whole set? Okay.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
But I think eventually I will start posting more and more of my materials because it's just like, you know what? I don't have that many followers. Like honestly, and what are the chances people are going to see? I don't want to be so precious about my material at the same time. So I think I could be a little bit better at posting more material.
Mm-hmm. Actually, so the headliner for the night at Absolute, I forget his name, but he was very good. He was very funny. And his I guess like his big joke, the punchline, that was something he posted on social media. And I was looking with my girlfriend on his account just like maybe a day before because we saw it and I forgot about it completely. And then when he says the joke, in my mind I'm like, I feel like I've heard this somewhere before, but I don't know why. And then my girlfriend goes, he posted it online. We literally watched it a day ago. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it was interesting because it wasn't like a negative reaction from me. I wasn't like, oh, I heard this. This is unoriginal. This is stupid. No, it was more like, oh, this is awesome. I saw this online and I'm hearing it now in person and it's still funny. And it's, for me at least, it's pretty cool to see a comic that I've never met before and only seen online say something in front of me. And it's like making it real.
Really?
Yeah.
So that didn't ruin the experience for
no,
you?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good to know. All right, now I feel better about posting more of my material.
Like, yeah, I think the joke, the finishing joke from your set. Obviously, it's not like advice, but I think if I could rewatch that, I would watch it a million times. Like, it was so good.
God, I had a lot of fun. I actually have an extended version of that I can't tell because I don't have time. I have an extended version of that, which I really have a lot of fun with it. But yeah, writing jokes is too much fun.
Yeah.
I love writing in general. Like I feel like if I could give up comedy, if I could just write books, I think I could do that. Like either writing books or writing comedy, I think I could do either or. Definitely not both.
Right.
I could also see myself like quitting comedy and then just going to a beautiful tiny European village, Italian village, and just be a writer, super romantic, and then just pump out books.
I love it.
That will be fun too.
I love it. That's that manifestation right there.
Yeah, exactly. Too many things I want to do, yeah.
So Darren, the last question I have for you, it's actually kind of something I like to do with every guest. I want to flip it on to you. Mm. I want to ask you if you have any question for me, one question for me about anything we talked about here or beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my question is actually about manifestation.
Okay, wonderful.
So I know you're a busy guy. You're doing an internship. You have this podcast. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that earlier you started this podcast, you kind of walked away and you're picking it back up. Mm-hmm. When you go through your manifestation process, what is exactly that you're manifesting?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll say to clarify, do you mean like in general, like anytime I'm manifesting anything, what am I focusing on?
No, not anything. Like just like one big thing. I would say, for example, for me, uh-huh. obviously be comedy. I want to be able to make it. I want it to be one day to be my full-time job. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like full-time job and while working at McDonald's. I mean like I want this to be my main source of income, yeah. and I'm really making it. That's my one big manifestation. One big thing yours be?
Yeah, I think it would be this podcast. I would love for this to become a legitimate source of income and like a legitimate way to live off of this.
Yeah.
And that's really what I try to manifest. I don't, for me at this moment, I don't really think about like, oh, I want to make $10,000 every 2 months, whatever. I don't think about the dollar value per se. I guess, okay. I guess I look at it like a big picture, like what's going to be the result? What is the outcome I want?
Okay.
In my manifestation. So like with the podcast, I want this to be my full-time job, but as a result, that the result of it is going to be, I get to talk to interesting people every week. I get to connect with people on a mm-hmm. deeper level, talk about things that maybe the audience wouldn't think about, or maybe people would find uncomfortable. Right. Try to break down stigmas of mental health, be a voice for mm-hmm. mental health for everybody, and especially men's mental health.
You touched on mental health quite a few times now, and then you, I don't think you made that very clear when we first met, mm-hmm. when we talked about your podcast. What is it about mental health that makes you want to lean in so much more?
I think it's, for myself, I've had my own experiences and struggles with my mental health, and it's something that I've worked on, and I'm in therapy, and I've been very open about that in previous episodes and with people. Mm-hmm. But I think I've, you know, of course, I've heard stories and I've met people who haven't always gotten the help they need. And so I think that for me, as somebody who has been fortunate enough to have the resources and the people in my life who care about me to help me get the help I need, I want to try to be that voice to maybe push somebody who's considering going to therapy, getting support or not, to hopefully mm-hmm. get them to take the necessary steps to help them.
Okay, so it comes from a very personal experience. Yeah. You benefited from this, so you want others to benefit from it as well.
Yeah, and I think there's also a pretty big stigma about mental health in general. And I mean, now with mm-hmm. with Gen Z, I think it's been breaking down that barrier,
yeah.
especially with social media. And yeah. everybody's like a professional psychotherapist on TikTok. I swear, like, but
it's true.
But yeah, like I still see like, that stigma. It's so present, and I think that it's important that we talk about it as a community, as a group, as a society, to like break down those barriers.
Yeah, this is very, very true. Yeah, stigma, it's a huge, that's something that I definitely see. Even, it's funny you said that, because even at the comedy clubs, even just a year ago from now, mm-hmm. the jokes about mental health have changed mm-hmm. in a good way. Mm-hmm. People used to make fun of like, they would use bipolar as a punchline. Mm-hmm. Which is like, so like when you think about it, I'm like, dude, that's not acceptable. Yeah. Like this is not like, you shouldn't punch down on people with bipolar illness. It's a very serious mental health issue. A year ago, I would hear that. Now, nobody says that. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, okay, people are, even comics are becoming more aware. It's like, I think that's good. I think certain level of awareness is definitely translating to comedy clubs where you can observe and like audience will tell you what you can or cannot get away yeah. with it.
Definitely.
So yeah,
I see that with like going back to how we were talking about that dark humor, where it's not really yeah. so much humor as it is just being offensive. When I see people making those dark jokes, I often have seen those people not experience anything they're joking about.
There you go.
And so that's where it's like, well, is this really coming from a place of experience and like you're trying to, you know, bring humor to this thing? Or is it really just right. You're just trying to speak your own beliefs and be racist and be offensive? Yeah. And that's kind of what I've seen there with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Audience smart, man. They will know. I think they will know.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially in Toronto. Yeah.
Definitely. Darren, I want to thank you for your time. Like, this has been an awesome conversation. Man. It's been amazing to sit down and
chat. Thank you. Yeah. This is so much fun. Thank you so much for organizing all this.
You know, thank you. Like, the energy, I really appreciate it. Before we go for the audience, do you want to plug anything?
Yes.
Everything will be in the show notes, like your socials, but anything you want to say, any last words?
Last words? I don't know. Wow. I haven't thought about this. So I guess the thing is, I guess things I will plug is I do so the four shows that I co-produce in Toronto, mm-hmm. It's at the place called The Real Jerk Legacy. It's a Jamaican restaurant, great restaurant, but at the bottom, it's a full-blown comedy club. They got a stage, they got everything. So that's, I'm there every Monday and Friday. Sorry, I'm there every Tuesday and Friday. And the other place I co-produce is at the Cameron House. I'm there every Monday and Wednesday. So a lot, all of them are free shows except for the Friday one. All of them are actually free of charge. And we made them free intentionally because we want to give comics the freedom to explore new material. That's the time also I go on stage, try a bunch of new material, hone my craft. We don't have to be as polished and as precise. Mm-hmm. And also make it free for like audience to come. Things are so expensive nowadays. We just want you to come, maybe buy a drink or two so you support a venue, because mm-hmm. that's how the venues survive. Venues, they don't charge us anything either. So it's like everything, it's all just free for everyone. Wow. So yeah, so I try to buy a couple of things when I go, just support a venue as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all these shows I mentioned, they're all free with the exception of Friday, because that's a pro show mm-hmm. where we actually pay comics and we pay like all the performers to come. So that one we charge. But yeah, so check this out. I know we're always having fun. I hope to see some of you there. Another thing I will plug is, this is such a shameless plug.
Go for it.
So I recently wrote a short story. Actually, it's about my immigration life, my journey to Canada. Every word of it is true. It's a wild story, but every word of it is true. And it's actually being published in an upcoming, I don't have the book yet, but the book will be published soon. I think sometime in mid-April. And the book is called The Moment of Clarity. And it will be available on Amazon. Go buy it. But I'm not the only story there. There are many, many stories. It's a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. But I will say this, is my story is the first one in the book.
There you go, page one.
So you can just read the first few pages and then throw the book away. No, I'm kidding. But I want to plug that just because the editor and the publisher has been so gracious in just helping me with my writing and giving me the space and opportunity to do this. And I want them to do well as well. So if you love short stories, check them out. And I will give you the link, for everything, once I have them.
Right on. To everybody listening, thank you for your time. I hope you all enjoy this episode. And Darren, once again, thank you, brother. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, David. All right. See ya.
Cheers.